Hello and welcome to Consumer Choice Radio. We're broadcasting here on the 1st of February 2020 on the Big Talker FM 106.7 out of Wilmington, North Carolina. Weekly choice that we get here on the Consumer Choice Radio. It's a weekly conversation. We've got the latest news, interviews, and expert analysis that covers consumer topics around the world. Our website, as always, is consumerchoiceradio.com, where you can find all the links and show notes that we're talking about. I am one of your co-hosts, Yael Osovsky, broadcasting to you now from the south of Spain. And then we have my colleague, David Clement, coming to us from Toronto. Hello, David. How goes it?
It's going pretty well. Looking forward to another great week of conversation and recap here.
Yeah, we've got a lot of topics to talk about, a lot of things to go into. It's been a crazy couple of weeks. We just got back from Davos, as you can probably hear in both of our voices. I think we're both succumbing to our illnesses, right?
Yeah. Certainly a mix of jet lag and being overtired. But we will push through.
Yeah, we'll push through. That's always kind of what we're doing here. So we've got a great hour of programming for you who are listening live, or those of you who are listening to the podcast or to any of the other programs that we've recorded. You can find all of our information on consumerchoiceradio.com. There we've got the Spotify link, the RSS feed, the Apple Podcast link, everything you need, plus our YouTube if you want to follow along. So, David, we got some great stories, very good things that we'll get into a bit later. Yep. Obviously, we've got some very good media hits that have been coming out of our stint in Davos last week. Some great stuff that we'll cover in a little bit, but it seems as if there's a lot of stuff going on. And from the sound of my voice, you would think I would be one of the people in one of these stories.
it's been what a crazy start to 2020. I mean, there were potentially war with Iran. We had Australia on fire or still on fire. Obviously, the tragic death of Kobe Bryant had everybody mourning and talking about that. And now we have what appears to possibly be the next most serious pandemic with the coronavirus out of China. And so it is, I mean, the year is 1 month old, but we're already on your catastrophe bingo. We're already hitting all of the spots in terms of what could possibly happen. So it's definitely been an eventful first month here of 2020.
And the coronavirus that we're hearing is, again, very similar to the SARS virus that broke out many years ago. I think everyone kind of has some kind of personal story related to that. I was actually slated to fly to Toronto I didn't know you yet, David, but slated to go up there, go to my cousin's bar mitzvah at the time. And it so happened that there was a case right there in the town where we were supposed to go, in Markham. So that did not happen, fortunately, but goodness, this is yet another, example of when all of us are about to become stars in the next Netflix series, all about a pandemic, epidemic, whatever you might call it, health scare around the world that's got global repercussions. And I did, obviously, the most dangerous thing that one could do in this time is that I got on a plane full of tourists and headed down to another place. So that probably wasn't smart of me, but I did actually check at the pharmacy before I left. But unfortunately, they had run out of face masks, totally out of them. So we'll have to figure out what to do on the way back. There's a lot of stories about exactly how this started. You can read a lot of the stories about exactly where in China this happens, or in Wuhan. So we're going to go ahead and play a small clip that is just about how this started, how infectious it is, and really where, really what this means for individuals who are perhaps could succumb to the sickness.
This new virus may be more infectious than SARS. Super spreading events must be occurring, otherwise the number would not jump so high. And now we are seeing human-to-human transmission in family clusters and also in the hospitals. We have seen patients, especially children, who have a pneumonia but has no symptom of fever or cough, which means that it is not easy to recognize these cases of novel coronavirus infection, which makes the control of this outbreak more difficult. Once you start to have cases that have no connection to Wuhan, means that there are local chain of transmission happening. and that is extremely worrying. So it is very important for us to control it. Everybody, once you are outside your home, on public transport, to workplaces, you must wear a mask. You must do frequent hand hygiene, and don't go near the hospital unless it's absolutely necessary. And of course, for healthcare workers, it's very important that all doctors and nurses must comply with infection control procedures. If the control measures are not working, or if the control measures are not being complied, then the trajectory could be very alarming. I just want to say that don't be complacent. We must treat it extremely seriously, because if you make a wrong decision in this stage in time, like what has happened in Wuhan, why not Hong Kong or other cities become Wuhan? Perfectly possible.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, this is it's hard to get a toll on exactly what is happening, where it's coming from. I mean, the stories that I've been reading is that you've actually had people who have contracted the virus who did not travel to China themselves at all, nor do they really know anyone in their immediate vicinity who had traveled to China, to Wuhan. So there's a lot of different stories as to how people can get affected, how long it kind of stays alive on various objects, like, let's say, a door handle or a table. It's pretty crazy. So we do have a little bit of insight from our colleague, Fred Roda. Fred is managing director of Consumer Choice Center and health economist. One of these guys on staff, right?
It does. Yeah, it helps to have him around when it comes to questions like this. I mean, the thing that's the most startling for me, so there's obviously all of these questions about transmission and how it goes from one person to another and how long it can last on surfaces and all of those things. But I think the thing is that is most startling to me is kind of the exponential growth in the cases that we've seen, because I know that we're well past 6,000 cases in China already, which exceeds SARS. So that's pretty frightening in terms of how we respond collectively and what the solutions are. So that's some pretty rapid growth. And I mean, obviously the impact of this could just be a grinding halt of global commerce and travel to various places and the productivity that's lost, not only for obviously those who are sick or could be sick, but everyone else who is then adjusting their behavior accordingly. So the ripple effects in the economy here are almost really hard to quantify.
Yeah, that's why we are seeing a lot of the markets down. A lot of people are very uncertain. I mean, this is a black swan, right? We don't know what's going to happen 2 weeks from now. The piece that is put together by Fred Roda, our colleague, we'll actually link to that in the show notes, consumerchoiceradio.com. He focuses a little bit on the World Health Organization and whether or not they have failed us in this aspect. Again, it's a bit early to tell, but it seems as if we didn't really have the great institutions in place. People were not really at the ready, and like many other instances, such as Ebola, they were not ready from the get-go. You know, isn't that why we fund these large bureaucratic organizations, so they can tackle this stuff, so they know what to do? There's been some very, very good reporting. Obviously, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, they've sent reporters. Imagine being that guy. Bill, your assignment, go to Wuhan, go to right to where the epicenter of this disease is, and get some good reports for us. So you do have some very good stories of reporters going there who are talking to some health experts who are in the area, some people work at the hospitals, and then, you know, just what we see from, as you said before, this is even faster than the SARS virus. So that's actually very scary. And another scary part that we've kind of seen is, you know, this is originated in China. And many of the early news stories about this were not the story of how the, you know, Chinese communist authorities were sending in all their best researchers and scientists. The first stories coming out of this was actually how the regime and their police officers were arresting people who were telling people about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is insane. This is you're facing this global virus that started in your neck of the woods, and you're just arresting and jailing people who talk about it and who have the gall to tell others to wash their hands and put on their face masks.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening. When I mean, You can be a supporter of limited government. You can be a supporter of a more expansive or big government. You can be a Republican. You can be a Democrat. But this is generally considered to be a core responsibility of government in terms of how we respond to collective crises like pandemics and flus and things like that. And to think that by pointing out where the virus is, that you could be arrested by the same entity that is supposed to be shielding or protecting your community or your city or your country from a virus is just terribly frightening.
Oh, yeah. And there was even a case, it's one of the first times, actually, there was some kind of lower court in China. Again, Western ignorance here. I don't exactly know what the trial and court system is, but there was a court that came out and said that there was a local doctor who had been arrested for going on WeChat and telling his followers, hey, this is actually a very, very bad case of SARS. This is very dangerous. Everyone needs to cover up, stay inside. And they actually arrested him for that for, spreading fake news. And the court actually said, okay, he might have been wrong that it was SARS, but it's definitely SARS-like. And the police need to stop arresting people who are spreading the truth about this. That's not what we should be doing. Now, that was kind of exciting to hear.
Yeah, that's at least a little bit of a step forward. But it also just makes you wonder, I mean, how bad – My biggest concern here is were cases and the spread of this, were they downplayed just to save face because they didn't want to look bad in kind of like the global sphere? They didn't want to have to deal with reputational damage. Now, I mean, we don't know how this is going to shake out, but if this progresses and it does actually turn out that there was a conscious and coercive process of suppressing people from pointing out that this virus was spreading, I mean, that is just absolutely tragic. And to think the lives that could be saved if that wasn't the case, the suffering that would have been avoided if it were to be handled properly. And I think really that brings this back to the WHO and some of the comments of our colleague Fred. I mean, a lot of people don't know that the World Health Organization actually spends more on travel than it does on combating key diseases. So we're talking $192 million on travel expenses last year. And a lot of that is things like business class and lounge access and all of these very fancy things. And I think when you combine the two of those, you really have a bad recipe here, and possibly a recipe for disaster, because you have a national government that's suppressing information, and then you have an international regulatory body or an international response body, or however we describe them, who seems to be a little more concerned on flying places first class than they are in terms of actually combating these diseases, whether it's AIDS or tuberculosis or Ebola or now coronavirus. That's incredibly problematic. I mean, it's certainly ethically questionable, but then also as a taxpayer, I mean, we're taxpayers in countries that contribute to the World Health Organization, and so there has to be some accountability there as well from that perspective too.
Of course. And all of you now are listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker FM 106.7. We're broadcasting out of Wilmington, North Carolina. We broadcast every Saturday at 10 a.m. David, looking at this, it's as if the show Chernobyl did not just come out, in which we saw the errors of a large sort of communist government that was faced with an unspeakable tragedy of humanity's making.
Yep.
And basically, instead of trying to face up to what had happened and try to fix it right away, they spent most of the few hours just blaming each other, trying to figure out who to blame, lying about it, hiding it under. I mean, again, we're going to see all of this in Netflix probably in some years to come. We'll see the real story where the Chinese communists are the bad guys. We'll see something come together. I think this is – it might be a turning point. There's some stories out of China that Xi Jinping, who's the head of China, head of the Secretary General of the party, so he hasn't really come out publicly much. He's actually sent the premier, the second guy in charge. He's Lip Kip Kiang. He's actually been out a little bit in the rubble. So they sent him out to Wuhan with only a mask, and he's just got to show up and assure people that China is going to take care of everyone and everyone's, you know, going to be fine. We'll see. Another, I guess, silver lining to this is there's a couple stories about how not only American and Canadian universities are sending their best research, but because the Chinese health authorities sort of unlocked the virus, they kind of put that out on their own public ledger. And it's they've invited public health experts not only from schools and universities and governmental institutions, but also private pharmaceutical companies to try to find some kind of antidote to this, some kind of antiviral drug. And there's a story that came out of the Wall Street Journal yesterday that Johnson & Johnson and Merck and a lot of these pharmaceutical companies are all sending all types of HIV drugs, which apparently have proven somewhat effective at combating similar viruses. So, man, this is maybe a moment in time that we'll talk about for years to come. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. It's yeah, like you said, a silver lining. Hopefully this is the all hands on deck moment where the various different entities can come together and say, okay, let's, what do we do? How do we get as much information as possible? And how do we solve this? I mean, one big thing that's going to come up, just forecasting a little bit, is something as novel as tariffs on pharmaceutical products. So, I mean, a lot of people don't know, but Chinese patients paid over $5 billion last year in tariffs on the drugs that they import from around the world. And so, I mean, that's a you and I often talk about, okay, well, how do, what are some easy solutions to make the rapid or what are some easy solutions so that we can rapidly fix this as quick as possible? Once we do have our best and brightest on it and we start to figure out what our next steps are and what maybe what medicines people need, I mean, that's got to be up there in terms of priority, is getting rid of those tariffs so that we can have the fast movement of whatever the medicine is, or if it's a vaccine, whatever it is, so that it can get to those affected or those possibly affected as quick as possible.
No doubt. And I mentioned before earlier in the program, I with the family flew along to southern Spain, and you know, there's a lot of people traveling. There were a lot of people that had on the masks at the airports. And we've already heard the last couple of months, we talked about it last program, this is the environmentalist push in places like Davos, get people to fly less. And there's an idea out there that if people are flying less, we'll contribute less to climate change. But what if this argument takes, you know, a whole other avenue? What if people start saying, hey, we should travel less because of all of these diseases? We've already seen that British Airways canceled all of their flights to China. There's been a lot of pressure on the Americans to do the same. There's been pressure on other countries. You know, what if that happens? What if all of a sudden people are up in arms and instead of saying we should stop flying for the environment, they start saying let's stop flying to stop all these diseases?
Well, yeah, I mean, that sounds intuitive, but there's actually a fairly compelling argument made by Dan Beer at freethink.com, talking about how the world is more interconnected today than it has ever been. I think the data on traveling is last year, around 4 billion passengers flew on commercial flights worldwide on over 55,000 different routes. So that's pretty considerable. And I mean, just growth in that regard, I mean, 4 billion. That's double the amount of passengers that flew in 2004. So we're seeing some exponential growth. But he makes the argument actually that this growing interconnectedness, while it might seem scary in the context of something like coronavirus, has actually allowed for humans to build up various immunities to all sorts of different viruses that actually make a plague-like virus less likely. And he references the Spanish flu and about and how basically in this was 1918, half a billion people were infected. It's about a quarter of the world's population at the time. And the argument is that a lot of that stemmed from the fact that at that time the world was not very interconnected. We didn't have that much exposure to each other, and so that allowed for more in terms of people who are immunocompromised. Now, I'm no vaccine or expert on any of these subjects, but I certainly did find that argument compelling in terms of maybe why we haven't seen a Spanish flu, like something that infects half or a quarter of the world's population. We haven't seen anything like that in the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah, and considering we are traveling a lot more, I mean, look at the number of tourists in any big city you've been to. People are coming from every single part of the world, every corner of the world, tourists from all over. It would be the perfect grounds to have this kind of virus, but you're right. You know, one of the first big killers in the New World in North America was not just the guns and the steel of the people who had come over from Europe, the colonizers. It was actually diseases, and it was a lot of these that they had never seen before, and that actually caused off way more deaths than physical, I guess, violence. So that's definitely something to think about. I guess I'm very thankful then that we fly a lot more, that our bodies are getting better at combating this.
Mm-hmm.
There's another story that showed that the temperature in our bodies has actually changed over time. I don't know if that's Uber related, but it's just showing that our bodies are always constantly evolving, having to fight new pathogens, new viruses that prop up out of the ecosystem. Our bodies are resilient or strong. Humans are awesome.
You know,
we've got many more battles to fight, but hopefully coronavirus is one that we can put behind us.
Yeah, so of course.
We'll see about that. You're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker FM, 106.7 FM in the morning. We're talking now about obviously a very sad and tragic human case, but then again, there are some things in the news that we can be happy about. David, this is happening right there in your neck of the woods. We've got some good news for all people who love mobility and who love the ability to choose. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so after what has been years of battling with the courts in British Columbia, and specifically, or more specifically, the city of Vancouver, the province of BC has legalized ride sharing. So something that is widespread throughout the United States in almost every major city wasn't actually legal in BC until just a week or so ago. And so finally, the good people of British Columbia will have access to ride sharing services. Tourists who are traveling to Vancouver or Victoria or anywhere else in the province will have access to ride sharing services. So it is a big win for consumer choice. We were quite closely involved in terms of the coalition that was pushing for that. All sorts of engagement locally there in terms of making the argument in favor of innovation, in favor of new disruptive products and services, and we won. So it's a good day to celebrate that. That said, there are some jurisdictions within British Columbia who are actually still fighting this, and one in particular is the city of Surrey, and they're basically saying, no, we're not going to listen to the province, and we're still going to ban Uber, and we're still going to ticket drivers and all sorts of nonsense. So we'll be certainly engaged on that. And I think we have a clip, actually, of the description there so that listeners can truly understand the insanity of what's going on in Surrey.
The ride-hailing battle in Surrey is heating up. Over the weekend, bylaw officers issued 18 warnings to Uber drivers for failing to have a business license.
For failing to have a business license. Sorry, just the journalistic talk. Sorry.
Mayor Doug McCallum defended the crackdown.
If a predator comes in an industry that's highly regulated and doesn't do a level playing field and ignores a lot of the laws of those cities, you would expect any mayor to stand up for their residents.
Some city council.
All right, so let's unpack this a little bit, David. He calls new entrants into the market predators.
Predators. I mean, this is nothing but cronyism on full display. He's only arguing for any of this to defend the taxi industry, And the reason why we know it, so he mentioned an industry that's highly regulated. And
I think he said regulated, though.
Yeah, yeah. A little off there, but so he's making this argument for, and we see this all the time, for equity, right? Well, they don't play by the rules. Okay, well, if it's about equity, well, then let's change the rules. Let's make it easier on taxi drivers as well. Let's deregulate the taxi industry like many cities in North America or globally have. If you want a level playing field, fine. Let's lower the bar, not raise it. And so
his argument as well, as he said, they came in and they didn't have an equal playing ground or something. Let's listen to that again.
Actually. Yeah.
Because he makes it sound as if they came in and now we're playing by their rules, which is not the case.
No, of course not.
Let's play this here.
Doug McCallum defended the crackdown.
If a predator comes in an industry that's highly regulated and doesn't do a level playing field.
Well, I think this mayor was sitting on his hands, just enjoying his salary, loving going to the lunches and cutting the red ribbons. And then this happened, and he's like, I got to do something.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Oh my goodness! All right, let's hear a little bit more of what he has to say, and then we can ridicule the regulations that come from this later.
And it ignores a lot of the laws of those cities. You would expect any mayor to stand up for their residents.
Some city councilors have also been critical in the use of bylaw officers.
Clearly, this is not good use of our resources in Surrey. Bylaw officers should be focusing their intentions on what they're supposed to be doing, and that is around public safety.
So there are mechanisms with the framework of what we currently have, as opposed to just saying, look, here's a warning for not getting a business license.
Ride-hailing was approved on Friday. Surrey immediately sent a cease letter. Uber declined. A statement reads, the premier has made clear that municipalities do not have the authority to prevent ride-sharing companies from operating. We do not believe there is any legal basis for drivers to be fined. Adding, Surrey has not created a business license for its operators.
There is different categories that they comply for. For example, they can apply for the same license as taxis.
The province released a statement saying the absence of a bylaw or business license in specific municipalities related to ride hailing is not grounds for refusal of the service.
Vancouver has issued one. There's probably a couple others that have issued before they start. And so maybe the Transportation Authority Board has more authority, actually, than the government. I don't think they do.
Warnings were handed out, but the mayor says the next time, ride-hailing drivers will be hit with $500 fines. Grace Key, Global News.
Just mind-boggling. And the worst part is it's not in that clip, but a reporter after the fact basically said, Mayor McCallum, if they applied for a business license, would you give them one? And guess what his answer was?
Let me guess. No.
No. So it literally is like the perfect example of cronyism. It has nothing to do with consumer safety. It has nothing to do with protecting the community. It just has all it is protecting an old industry from competition. There are easy solutions if you care about equity. Just lower the bar. Make it easier for taxi drivers so that you can have that competition. Consumers certainly benefit from that. And I think the one thing that is the real misstep is we actually know from really good research that the longer ride sharing is not legal, the more you continue to see impaired driving arrests. So there's great research from a few jurisdictions in the United States that shows for every month that ride sharing is legal, you see a 0.8 reduction in impaired driving arrests. And so you actually see community safety and consumer safety increase as a result of the availability of these services, because there are a lot, it's just an easier decision for people to make when they, let's say, leave a bar or a restaurant rather than making the dumb decision to get behind the wheel of a car. They use an app, call an Uber, and they get home safe. And so he may want to carry the banner of saying, we're protecting the community. We're protecting community safety. No, you're not. The evidence isn't there. And it's just so obvious that, he's just trying to protect this old, industry in need of disruption from competition. Yeah.
And old industry from its regulation.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. I think since I'm in Spain now, there's very good examples of where Uber came in and a lot of the taxi drivers were, of course, not happy with it and protest as much as possible. But at the same time, they did increase a lot of their services. They started having their own apps. They started allowing to have other drivers who could sign up just as easily. They actually made it a little bit easier for people to get taxi licenses. So they changed their laws. They changed their processes as businesses. It was actually a very positive thing. And now you have Uber, but people also can take taxis, and it is very competitive. And I think that's exactly what they don't want to happen in places outside of Vancouver downtown. And again, the only reason that you're celebrating this, David, is because Vancouver has been one of the I mean, it's one of the largest cities in all of North America. It's one of the only places where you haven't even had any ride sharing be legalized.
And so. there are hilarious photos. I mean, they're also somewhat tragic, but they are hilarious, of the lineup for taxis at the Vancouver airport. I would not wish that experience upon anyone in my entire life. It is horrendous. You see people waiting 45 minutes plus for a taxi because obviously supply is limited. It's a world-class city. People go there to explore BC, which is this beautiful, beautiful province. And in some instances, you have people flying from, let's say, Calgary or even Winnipeg, and they end up spending more time waiting for a taxi than they did on their flight to Vancouver. Which is just insane. So it's nice to see that this will progress forward. Hopefully the mayor of Surrey can give his head a shake and figure it out in terms of what people actually want, because we know that the residents of Surrey want this. We know that the folks BC wide want this. And so, it's going to be a battle, but we're going to be there front and center. I was on the radio earlier this week in BC talking about this. So hopefully we can make some change and get Surrey on the right direction.
That's right. You're listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker FM, 106.7 FM in the morning, Saturdays at 10. We've got a couple of great media hits that have come from not only our colleagues, but some of our work in Davos in the last week. So I'll point some of our listeners over to the show notes at consumerchoiceradio.com, where we list some of them. We got some very big hits here in the last couple of days here, David. There's one that we didn't get to mention last week, but the Consumer Choice Center actually got a very good mention in the Financial Times of London.
Yes.
Not a positive one, though.
Yeah, they were critical. So for listeners, the background on this is there's an EU proposal to standardize the charging mechanism for cell phones. Is it just cell phones or is it all appliances? I'm not actually familiar if it's just cell phones or not.
Yeah, so this would be a common mobile phone charging.
Okay. Yeah. So basically to say all phones sold in this geographic region have to have this particular charging mechanism. And in some senses, I can maybe understand why one would want to do that. I mean, I know that I was particularly frustrated when Apple switched to their most recent port for charging. But our colleague, our European colleague, Maria, actually very rightly pointed out that all that does is bring all phones down to the lowest kind of common denominator in terms of efficiency. And it raises some real risks in terms of like product viability in the long term. So as soon as any innovation comes out, all phones are replaced rather than just the few that maybe have the poor charging outlet. We were mentioned in the Financial Times as the dissenting voice saying, hold on a second, having some differences here may actually be a positive, allows for more innovation, it allows for different companies to experiment a little bit. And so, that was a big one for us.
And in the common standard that they're trying to impose in Europe is the micro USB. And this is what a lot of devices have. I think most Android phones, people use that. But the thing is, at the same time, we have USB-C, which is this kind of faster, newer plug-in. A lot of Mac devices use this. Some others use it. This is coming up right now. You know, a lot of devices are using this. It's much quicker. You can do not only sound, but data, video. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many things you can do on this. Yep. This is becoming a new industry standard. And the question becomes, should we have a law that's written at year X to determine what every single sort of innovation or technological device should use from here on out? I mean, it just sounds crazy. If we had that, we'd have the government sort of sponsored HD DVD. We'd still be, you know, listening to CD-ROMs. There are so many other things that are just ridiculous. We'd have countless examples. So, yes, very good hit by Maria Chaplia, Financial Times. Great to have mentioned there. Some of the other ones are also very good. Our colleague Biel Wiltz, as we mentioned, writing in French and German, writing a lot about specifically agroecology and science. It's actually been great to read a lot of his stuff. He's getting much more influential sort of in the scientific journalism world, writing a lot about, you know, what happens with plastics, what happens with old technology and when we're trying to recycle it. Specifically a lot about who's authorizing certain medications, and whether or not consumers have the right to have that kind of information. And then we have a lot of media hits coming out of Davos again, David. So if you could just kind of line up a couple of those that we were loath to mention last week.
Yes. Yeah. So we did. We had some additional hits describing the event. So obviously last week, I had discussed how the event was dubbed the rebellious side of Davos. There was actually some additional coverage on that headline. So one being with the outlet Benzinga talking about how the conclave was dubbed the rebels of Davos and what some of the key takeaways were there. That was fantastic, as well as Growth Inc. A gentleman out of Belgium highlighting the impact of the event. And then in German, in Humph Journal, describing Humph. Okay,
like,
sorry.
Hemp.
Okay, there we go.
It's like Hemp, you know, that guy Hemp.
Forgive my German. It's not very good. In that outlet, also describing the success of the event. And then one other one, which kind of goes back to what we just chatted about, was in the Vancouver Sun. So they did an expose on the ongoing legal battle between Uber and the city of Surrey and featured our comments as the dissenting voice and some of the research that we've put together on how ride sharing helps with consumer safety and community safety. So it has been it's been a great week on the media front.
Yeah, there's been a lot of great things and some new projects that we've announced here at Consumer Choice Center. One good one that we'll hear more about in the coming weeks on the fellow programs to come is the new Global Gene Editing Regulation Index. Mm-hmm. This is a project that was launched with the Genetic Literacy Project. You can find more about that on the consumerchoicecenter.org website. This is actually amazing. This is a global tracker that looks at every single country in the world and classifies them by their known level of regulation on gene editing. Now, gene editing is not as scary as it sounds. It is very futuristic, but what gene editing is allowing us to do now is to be able to investigate the DNA of particular bodies, proteins, whatever it might be, splice them, copy, paste, and figure out a way that we can live longer lives, healthier lives, we can provide better food, we can provide better medicine, and it really is a super fascinating field. Many countries are very behind in that they do not allow a lot of experimentation here. Others are very, very far ahead. So a very, very good index. That's something that I would definitely recommend you guys check through. Maybe you'll learn something, one or two, about the U.S. or your own you know, favorite countries. Pretty crazy to see all the differences. And if, again, there's I hate to keep going back to Netflix documentaries, but there have been a few very, very good ones on human-led evolution all about gene editing. So again, more things that we can connect to the work that we're doing every day at Consumer Choice Center and some of the great innovations that are happening out there in the world for everyone to see.
Yeah, yeah. It's gene editing can sound like a very intimidating subject, but I encourage all of our listeners to dive into the great work of our colleagues and to start that learning process. I know I certainly did, because that is not my not my bread and butter. But yeah, it's fascinating what we can do. I mean, I always think of this as like, imagine actually being able to come up with a cure or to prevent anyone from ever having ALS again, or any really debilitating disease or things like that. And so, that's the future that I want to live in. And, it's, we're hopeful that with this type of index and reporting, legislators can start to catch on in terms of what models they need to replicate to allow for experimentation, to allow for advancement and that innovation to really take hold.
Oh, yeah, David. And if we're able to change our own genes and get the next drugs and live forever, we'll be doing Consumer Choice Radio well into our hundreds. Good man.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. It will be episode 1,777 of Consumer Choice Radio with 100.
Season 8 and continuing on. Yeah, yeah. So a lot of great stuff to come there. You can find all the details, consumerchoiceradio.com. We'll have everything linked and listed. You are listening to Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker FM 106.7 FM. David, we've got a couple other stories that we've put into the show notes here for the listeners to poke around and read. Again, you mentioned before, it's been a crazy 2020. Some things have changed a little bit in the United Kingdom. We've talked about this a little bit. Brexit actually is – today's Brexit Day, February 1st, now that we think about it. Today is the day that the United Kingdom is supposed to exit the European Union. Barring any unforeseen circumstance, that means that I will lose my bet that I made online on Predictit. So it goes. But this does mean a huge change in regulations between citizens of the United Kingdom and their government, and also their ability to be portable throughout the European Union. A lot of the institutions, there's actually a Daniel Hannan who... I think he's a friend of the show.
I would certainly describe Dan as a friend of the show.
Daniel Hannan, friend of the show. He's been a member of the European Parliament since 1999 in South England. He just gave his last speech a few days ago in Brussels in the European Parliament. He's a great friend of the show. We'll try to get him on to get his take about what's next for Britain and free trade and all the great things that will come up for that. He's actually specifically been working on trade, so it'd be great to hear which countries they're looking at next. There's one article here, one snippet of news that came out about the United Kingdom. This has to do with the building of the 5G network. I was very surprised. I was walking around here in Spain, and Vodafone, which is one of the larger companies, they apparently already have a lot of these 5G towers available. And people can actually pick up this separate device. It has to be only a certain level. I think it's LG that makes it, or one other, that makes this particular cell phone that connects to these towers that can get you 5G. So much, much faster, more pointed internet. And I was very surprised to see that. For the future of the UK's 5G infrastructure, there were some inklings that they would follow the United States and keep out companies that were based out of China because of national security concerns. But now there's an article here in the Wall Street Journal that tells us that is not the case. Mm-hmm. The United Kingdom is actually going to allow the Chinese telecom company Huawei to build parts of their 5G network. This is a pretty big shift. I think this is one of the only larger sort of NATO countries that is going to be allowing this to happen.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it gives me I would say it's a little concerning. I think the devil is obviously in some of the details, hardware, software, where these connections are actually going to be. I still think the big red flag is can Huawei prove that it would not comply or be compelled to do Beijing's wishes in terms of whatever the Communist Party of China wants it to do. And I'm only saying that because there's a clear pattern between some of these larger industries and their inability to kind of stand up to the Communist Party. And so I think that's the big question, is do they have the fortitude to respect the democratic values of the countries that they operate in terms of consumer privacy? I mean, there was an issue in, I believe it was Italy a while ago, where back doors were put in against people's wills or against kind of consumer knowledge. Is that something what we're going to, is that something along the lines of what we're going to have to worry about? That sounds like a pretty concerning scenario for me. But again, the devil is in the details. We'll have to wait and see the exact specifics in terms of what they'll be involved in and whether or not those risks kind of bear fruit.
Yeah, and these kind of arguments are very new in the, I would say, the Anglosphere, the English-speaking world, because this has been happening for years in places across Africa, certainly in different parts of Europe, including Italy and Spain. There has been a great entrance of very large Chinese firms who come along with, obviously, their workers and their ways of working and their connections to the Chinese Communist Party, and that has really worried a lot of people. Because, again, the Chinese people, amazing people, best people ever, love them. But what we're talking about here is intrusions by the Chinese Communist Party. You cannot, we cannot reasonably expect that any large Chinese company, specifically that working in technology, is not somehow connected to the Chinese Communist Party. Those who are board members are required to be members of the Chinese Communist Party. People are required to report back. I mean, there's very concerning stories that are coming out about researchers. There's one where it's actually the head of the chemistry department at Harvard. He was actually accused of lying to the Defense Department, to the National Institutes of Health, all about his connection to the Chinese government. It seems that there was a some kind of scholarship program that the Chinese government had put together whereby they would go to top-tier American universities and they would offer the big researchers large cash grants with the only stipulation that they did not disclose it to anyone else. This is an article of the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, we can talk about everything that's happened with 5G. We can talk about maybe there are concerns. But there are actual real concerns that have already happened with theft of intellectual property. And why not go to the source? Why not go right to the universities and the laboratories of innovation where it happens? I mean, it's a perfect strategy.
Yeah, that's that's concerning. That's definitely an issue. I mean, the whole secretive nature of that is problematic. So I think the big thing here, and you alluded to this a little bit, is by no means are any of these discussions anti-Chinese. What we're talking about is the reach of the Communist Party, and I think that that in and of itself should be something that Republicans and Democrats, progressives and libertarians should be able to kind of unite behind, because the Communist Party is certainly not something that we want to emulate in terms of its values or how it treats its citizens. And so that's just a guard we have to set for ourselves in terms of these ongoing discussions of interconnectedness and the relationship to business and things like that.
Yeah, and there's so many examples that have been kind of coming out the last couple of days. We talked everything in the beginning of the show about the coronavirus, about how you know, the Communist Party has approached certain things. If the first instinct, you know, when the huge health crisis is happening, is to crack down on the people who are getting smart on the internet, yeah, your priorities are in the wrong place.
So yes,
definitely something that's very concerning. There's going to be a lot more to come out of that Consumer Choice Center in our Project 21 Democracy. We're going to follow that very closely, and we'll have some pretty big announcements that we're going to hold to our chest for right now, David. But let's see, what else is in the news here? We've got about 10 minutes to go. We're right here almost to the top of the hour on Consumer Choice Radio on the Big Talker FM. What do we got here? We have the Iowa caucuses that are going to be happening here in 2 days, actually, 2 days from now.
Yep.
The presidential caucuses are scheduled for the 3rd of February. So finally, we're going to have some kind of result from this entire dog and pony show that has been the presidential nomination contest for mostly the Democratic Party. Republican Party, it's pretty set in stone. It'll be Trump.
Of course.
But finally, we'll get some results out of this.
Yeah. What's your take? Who do you think is going to take Iowa? Do you think that this is going to be indicative of the how the election goes at large? What's your view here?
Well, it seems now that Iowa has always been about how many people you've got there, how many resources have you thrown in, how close have you gotten to the people, and you know, the early polls are showing that it's actually Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
It looks like Bernie Sanders Day. And Bernie Sanders, you know, it's exactly the type of race that he would win, because this is normally very passionate people. And for listeners who don't know, this is a caucus. This is not a primary. It's not like in the state of North Carolina, or I believe it's in May, you'll go to your local elementary school or your local place where you vote and just cast a ballot. This is like you going to the local town center, and you actually have representatives of the candidates who give their spiel about why you should vote for their candidate, and you kind of do a show of hands type deal. It's a very strange way of doing it. It's very, you know, 1800s, but Iowa's kept this. It's the first in the nation.
Yep.
I think the more passionate people usually are the ones who are able to get more votes, because they're able to get more people there. So we could see, you know, an opening salvo for Bernie Sanders. Who knows? I think that's where a lot of it is. This is leaning, but, you know, there's many other states that will be coming after that. We'll definitely have New Hampshire, have some very interesting results from South Carolina, just south of where this is broadcasting out of. I think it's Bernie's to take. That's kind of my early prediction. I know Elizabeth Warren's star was very bright, but it seems as if she's faded in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think she's even behind Mayor Pete right now, at least in terms of the latest polls. So I do think it is Sanders to take. It will be interesting to see if we see a bit of a Biden surge at all, if he can push through. Mayor Pete is probably within striking distance, but I don't think he's got the grassroots support to do it. I will say that I think we could be in for a surprise on the side of Andrew Yang. Not that he'll win,
okay.
But I do think that based on the tenacity of the Yang gang, I think that he could have more support than people give him credit for. I know that Dave Chappelle is actually in Iowa campaigning with Yang. So we'll see whether that has an impact. But it'll be interesting nonetheless to see who wins this, and then if that actually shifts the direction of the race, and if it shifts where who drops out next. Does it show that certain candidates that they just do not have the legs to get there to be competitive, or will it be such an even field where everybody stays in and they're in it for the long haul? So exciting times for those who are political junkies who like to watch the polls and all of those things.
Well, speaking to Andrew Yang, I mean, lest we forget that Ron Paul in 2012 there at the Iowa caucuses really was within second place. You know, he was eventually boxed out to third. But, you know, again, we're only talking about a couple of – it's like 20,000 maybe votes per candidate. It's not much. It's just a couple of people, and this is really what's going to change the tide of the entire narrative. It's going to change fundraising. It's going to change who the media – come on, let's just say this because it's true – who the media will focus on as the candidates of choice.
Yep.
There's a lot of people that we might like, as we've mentioned, who have very good ideas that would be great ideas for consumer choice, who might not get mentioned for that very reason. But, yeah, this could be some interesting times. I think it's hopefully going to shake some things up. Maybe we can get some better ideas. I mean, we're just stuck right now on – what are we stuck on? Basically letting the government take over all of our health care, raising taxes on all the millionaires and billionaires and everyone else
Actually,
in the country.
Speaking of millionaires and billionaires, I think this will be a real test for Bloomberg and Steyer – or Steyer, or however you pronounce his name. I think if they can't put together any type of real grassroots support here – it's going to be a hard slog for them to go all the way through to is it still called Super Tuesday?
Yeah, that'll be in March. I believe it's second Tuesday in March.
Yeah, exactly. So We'll see. I mean, I think this is a real test for them because they've certainly bought their way onto the debate platform in terms of ad space. But is that going to translate into people actually believing that they could be president and wanting them to be president? I don't know. So we'll see.
Bloomberg. So if you watch any television and you're in the United States right now and you see any ads and it's a weekend, you're likely going to see three billionaires on your television. You're either going to see Trump, you're going to see Tom Steyer, or you're going to see Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah.
And I have to give some props to Tom Steyer. So those of you who are listening in South Carolina, you will have seen a lot of Mr. Steyer. He spent a lot of money there. He put most of his eggs into the South Carolina basket.
Yeah.
He's invoked South Carolina or some small South Carolina towns at every debate. Oddly enough, it's towns I've like driven through that I'm like, no one will ever mention this nationally. But he spent a lot of money there, and he came second in some recent poll. Again, who knows if he bought it off? We don't know anything about these. But hey, something could be there. Maybe it would only be South Carolina. Again, these are just billionaires who are playing with a lot of money.
Yes,
who are just getting very creative. I mean, if we started the David Clementi, Ilovsosky consulting group for any politician, we'd probably tell them to spend their money elsewhere. But
yeah, possibly, yeah. possibly. Yeah, it's funny. I think if you look, so right now in Iowa, Steyer is at 3%. I think in South Carolina, he's creeping up towards 9%. So it is having some impact. It is having some impact. It's not going unnoticed, but whether or not it actually translates, like you said, a state like Iowa, I mean, it really is who you know. If you talk to any Democratic kind of organizers on the ground, we're talking backyard barbecues, we're talking fall fairs, meet and greets. You're really, as cliche as it sounds, shaking hands and kissing babies and all of that. And that matters in Iowa. And so we'll see who's good at that and maybe who isn't, and how that translates into votes.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get some better ideas out of that too. We'll see. There's going to be a lot more races to come, a lot more analysis. I think, we've got some good shows in store, David, for the listeners. We've got, I think, some pretty good stuff in the works. Some very good interviews coming up the next couple of weeks. Some very good analysis, as always. The work that we're doing at Consumer Choice Center gets better every single week. Our colleagues are doing amazing stuff all over the world. Very, very proud of the team and everything everyone is doing. David, any preview of kind of what we can look forward to here in the next couple of weeks from you or Canada or anywhere else in the world?
Yeah, so I think we may be having the goal would be in the next few weeks to be having some fairly large names on the podcast or on the show and the podcast. Can't confirm them now, so you'll have to wait and see. But we're hoping to have some real head turners on the show to kind of add to our insight. So stay tuned for those announcements.
Great, we're gonna have some great friends of the show on the Beyond to give their analysis of consumer choice, of all the great political issues and ways that you can empower yourself. So we've got much more to come there. Got to thank everyone for listening. You can find all the show notes at consumerchoiceradio.com. We are broadcasting on the Big Talker FM 106.7 FM out of Wilmington, North Carolina. I am part of your co-host right here, Yael Osowski, broadcasting from Malaga, Spain with a terrible cold, hopefully not the coronavirus. We're feeling good. It was a great broadcast. Thanks so much, David, for being on the horn with me.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, for listening. Reminder to follow us on Twitter, tweet your questions or guest suggestions to us, subscribe to us on all of the apps, listen to us live on the radio. Thank you for being with us, and we'll see you next week.
All right, until then, bye-bye.